Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by Jean, I think I can pick games, Hodge, and JC Abbott out on the West Coast. Hodge, what do you have to say for yourself, bro? You ate a bunch of points, and you ain't looking so fat and sassy about it, my friend.
I mean, I went 2-2 against the spread. It's not a great week, but y'all can't pretend that it was some kind of disaster. That's not fair.
I'm just getting at you because you ate all those points in the past.
I did.
But yeah, 2-2 is respectable.
It's not good, but it's not bad. So hopefully this week we're batting a little higher. JC also went 2-2. Why aren't you picking on him? Come on.
Hey, I didn't make a big deal about eating the points. I'm just bag at picks.
Oh, fair enough.
He's owning it. Let's get rolling, boys. Today we're discussing the winners and losers from week one in the CFL. Yes, some hot takes are coming.
The league backtracking on the use of microchipped footballs in the kicking game.
The Hamilton Tiger Cats adding an intriguing young quarterback with a notable last name.
The Argonauts releasing former all-star defensive lineman Sean Oakman.
And the CFL returning to CTV for the first time since 1986. But first,
Hodge, the West Division heavyweight Winnipeg Blue Bombers and BC Lions suffered upset losses in week one. Those are the two games you were eating all the points, by the way. While Hamilton lost to Calgary and Edmonton, just wanted to remind you, fell to the Riders. Should any of these losing teams be pressing the panic button?
There is one team that should be pressing the panic button, and that team is the Edmonton Elks. And I understand that they are just 0-1, but I am starting to think, honestly, boys, that this team is cursed. Somebody has done something nefarious with a Ouija board or a voodoo doll or black magic or something. This is a team that spent the offseason bringing together all of this like amazing alumni. Like, y'all saw on social media, the, you know, the Matt Dunnigans and the Warren Moons, all those incredible names, individuals who came together for this game. And what did the universe give them? They gave them an Edmonton Oilers Stanley Cup run. So it got almost no media attention that there were all these legends at the game. They also got rained on during this game. They're desperately trying to get people back to Commonwealth Stadium. Well, guess what? Mother Nature spits in your face and gives awful weather, fans having to sit there in ponchos. And then, of course, this team touted all of the additions they made this offseason. Guys like McLeod Bethel-Thompson, Javon Leak, Boris Beattie, Robert Khemdiche, former first-round NFL draft pick. Well, guess what? You're up 13 points. Fourth quarter comes along. Robert Khemdiche takes a terrible penalty. Javon Leak loses a fumble. McLeod Bethel-Thompson throws a pick and loses a fumble. And Boris Beattie kicks a field goal so wide, it made Sergio Castillo's microchip misses look close. It was a comedy of errors late. And the reason I say that this should be a panic button situation for the Elks is because look at their schedule. They are playing the Montreal Alouettes this week, a team that looked unbelievably good at Princess Auto Stadium in week one. Then they have to go on the road to Toronto, a team which, though I incorrectly predicted the result of the game, I did say would be much better than people predicted, with Cameron Duke showing out and that defensive line being dominant. And then in week four, they're on a short week to Vancouver, where they have to play a motivated Lions team after flying across this absolutely gigantic, beautiful country of ours. So this team needs to be, this was the must-win game, the home game against Regina, when you've got all of these amazing alumni coming through and all of these great additions making their debuts, and they fumbled it away. And you wonder if this team is 0-4 come the end of week four. I'm not saying they will be, but if they are 0-4 come the end of that week, they have a bye in week five. You have to wonder, could they make a coaching change? Because if you're 0-4 and you've got to salvage this season, do something to bring the fans back, if you're 0-4, firing Chris Jones might be the thing to do. So I'm very curious to see how this team comes back. Montreal is going to be a super tough out, but this feels like a must-win game for the Elks already in week two.
It really does. And I don't want to spend too much time on the Elks because you pointed out their issues so eloquently. But if you're finding ways to lose games in ridiculous manners over and over again for multiple years, it's not a curse. It's a culture problem, right? There is something in that building that is not allowing them to be in a position to win football games. They are not able to finish it out. They don't have that trust and camaraderie with each other. To me, that comes to the coaching, and I don't think this solution gets fixed until we have them move on from Chris Jones. I think that has to be signed, sealed, and delivered at this stage. I do not believe in the Edmonton Elks, even though their offense for 3.5 quarters looked much improved, I still don't trust that defense, and I don't trust Chris Jones in charge. But for me, the most surprising of these losses was the two heavyweights, right? We saw the Bombers come out flat. I think that is an anomaly for them. I don't expect it to be repeated, and I'm not sure there's a bunch of core issues with that team that I can point to right now and say this is going to be a problem for them in 6 weeks, in 10 weeks. But I looked at the BC Lions, and there was questions about this team coming into week one. Some of the changes that they made to their roster, some of the departures, and you wondered how it was all going to fit together. And it seemed like they made changes at every position except the one that cost them, and that was left guard. Their offensive line has not been good enough for several years. It's still not good enough. And they go into Toronto, a game they could have won. Their quarterback, Vernon Adams Jr., throws for 360-plus yards, looks amazing for much of that game, and they can't protect him when it matters in the fourth quarter. They give up 6 sacks on that game, 5 of which came in the second half, all 5 of those within a quarter and 3 minutes at the end of the third quarter. When the chips were down, when they needed to get points in a 1-score ball game, that was unacceptable from the BC Lions, and I don't think that there is a solution to that problem currently in the building, at least short term, which is a major problem and has me the most concerned about them than anybody else.
The Winnipeg Blue Bombers, to me, were just a little bit off. Zach Collaros, on a couple of those throws, especially the one where he scrambled outside of the pocket and threw it to the end zone, was really close to having a different look to that game. The question marks for Winnipeg are going to be, can they go into Ottawa and get a win without Brady Oliveira? And will this offense be able to be at its peak production level or close to it with Kenny Lawler on the 6-game injured list? That said, I think that that game was set up well for Montreal because the last team they had played last year when they won the Grey Cup was the Blue Bombers. They knew Buck Pierce's offensive scheme inside and out. Yes, there's going to be different things, but by and large part, the majority of those offensive starters were back. And Montreal has shown that they play largely mistake-free football, which is kind of surprising to say, under Jason Moss and Danny Maciocia. Hamilton losing in Calgary, I expected to happen, but I think there was flashes of positive signs from Bolivar Mitchell. That said, in the receiving core, guys like Shamar Bridges, who are really young and seem to have upside that Ed Hervey and Scott Milanovich like because they're bigger targets, I think you're going to have some growing pains. And Tim White has to come down with that deep shot football in the end zone. And if he does, I think we're possibly talking about the Ticats as winners in that game. There are a lot of weird feelings around Edmonton. I do think Chris Jones's time as a GM and head coach in this league are quickly coming to an end. Hodge, the way you laid it out in terms of him potentially being let go during their bye week in week five makes a lot of sense. And I wonder if Jarius Jackson, who I feel like has a bit of a younger energy about him, could actually get the most out of this current Elks team. And then you look at the Lions, who lost on the road in Toronto. I felt like that would happen, or at least that the Argos would cover the spread. A lot of people picking this team, JC, to make the Grey Cup. I don't know if that's just because it's in Vancouver at BC Place, but there are some issues with this team that have to get corrected. Let's call it what it is, right? Cameron Dukes is making, I think it was his third start in his CFL career. And he looks super sharp, high completion percentage. Yes, I know Toronto's offensive line is the best one in the league, but the defense gives up 35 points, doesn't really get a lot of pressure on Dukes, who is fleet-footed and can get outside the pocket and make some plays. But I think there are a lot of concerns with that BC team. This is not the team that had Nathan Rourke on it back in 2022, and I don't think this team is as good as the BC Lions team that was on the field last season in 2023.
They certainly don't look like it. And my concern is you made the switch philosophically on that defense. You say, okay, we're losing Matthew Betts, our best pass rusher. We'll try and recreate him in the aggregate, but we're really going to focus on getting bigger up front. We're going to get better against the run because we know that's how Winnipeg's beaten us in the playoffs. We're tired of hearing the criticisms that we can't stop the run. So we're going to construct a team with Christian Covington in the middle, and we'll give Josh Banks more playing time, and we'll move Josh Woods into a starting linebacker role, and hopefully he can get more aggressive, and we'll stop the run. And then early in that game, not only did Cameron Dukes look great at quarterback with very little pressure, Kadeem Carey, for I think three quarters of that football game, was running at will against the BC Lions. Now, it wasn't big home run hits. He wasn't ripping off 20 yards and scoring touchdowns. But when he needed 4 or 5 yards, he was getting 4 or 5 yards every time. Some of that is that offensive line. But those problems were supposed to be fixed with the philosophical change. It looks like they haven't been, and they've lost their pass rush in the meantime. That's a big problem because you can't win in the CFL if you can't get after the quarterback. And if you can't stop the run either, well, teams can do whatever they want against you at that stage.
I was also surprised at how little Christian Covington flashed in that game. It's only one game. He hasn't played with a yard off the ball maybe ever in his entire life, right?
Yeah, like never.
BC at the amateur level plays 4-down football. He went to I believe he went to prep school before going to Rice, and then obviously went straight to the NFL. Point is, I appreciate that he might need some time to adjust, but I was expecting more from a 9-year NFL vet. To me, at the end of the day, though, when it comes to Winnipeg and BC, these are teams that have earned the benefit of the doubt by their play over the last 3-4 seasons. The Edmonton Elks almost deserve the opposite, right? They not only don't deserve the benefit of the doubt, they have to prove you wrong for anybody to believe in them. And the same issues that have plagued them the last number of years plagued them again this week. The Montreal Alouettes and Toronto Argonauts recorded impressive upset wins over Winnipeg and BC, respectively, while the Stampeders beat Hamilton and Saskatchewan completed a comeback against the Elks. Which winner impressed you the most in week number one, JC?
I thought the Alouettes and the Argonauts are still the best teams out there, but I don't think their results were necessarily shocking. We knew those rosters were talented. I had questions about Cameron Dukes, particularly as a player, that he answered, but the rest of the roster was as expected. The team that I was most impressed by was the Saskatchewan Roughriders and how they kept it together and found a way to win. I know a lot of teams will say, well, you almost lost to the Elks, right? They had to collapse at the end for you to pull out that victory. But I liked what our contributor Joel Gasson said in his post-game column, which is it's process over results. And if you watched that football game, even when the Riders were losing, it looked like they had the right process, like that offense was more poised than it was before, like the pieces were there, and it just took a minute for it all to come into place. And then in prime time, with everything on the line in that fourth quarter, they're able to stage that huge comeback. Trevor Harris shows he has chemistry with Sean Bain Jr. for two touchdowns in that final quarter to flip the score and get the victory in week one. Corey Mace's first one as a head coach. This is a team that I caution with all the optimism coming in to the season about Mace and the additions, that it was going to take a little bit of time for them to find their chemistry, for them to gel as a unit and to be able to win tight games like this. Well, they proved they were able to do it in week one. To me, that puts them ahead of the schedule where I thought they might be. And that's really impressive when you've got a new head coach on the sideline and a lot of new faces, both on offense and defense.
The Argos, for me, were the most impressive team in week one, as much for their performance on the field as they were for fighting through the distractions that that team has had to deal with off the field due to the Chad Kelly lawsuit, subsequent suspension, and potentially being without him for a minimum of 9 games. And Ryan Dinwiddie has gone on the record. I think this kind of went a little under the radar that, you know, he's not necessarily counting on Kelly to come back for sure. They're in contact very, what would be the right word, consistently. And I think there's a possibility, but he's fully focused on making Cameron Dukes the best quarterback that he can be. And we talked about it going into that game that Dinwiddie has been successful with quarterbacks in his scheme. We've alluded to it with Nick Arbuckle and how comfortable he was in the blue, double blue scrimmage, blue and white scrimmage, whatever they call it. And I felt like this quote was telling after the game from Dinwiddie about Toronto's approach. He said, quote, "A lot of people are picking the Lions to be in the Grey Cup. We beat them at home. Big deal. We got to go to Vancouver and win a damn game. We should beat them at home." Dinwiddie's thinking this with a team that has had some significant roster turnover, not just being without Chad Kelly, Jamal Peters on defense, gone, and a number of other guys that were up and coming, I guess you would talk about, and Dwayne Hendricks and Brandon Barlow, AJ Ouellette.
Quantez Stiggers
is a leader. Yes, Quantez Stiggers. Thanks for correcting me there, buddy, or catching me up. And the interesting thing about Ouellette was Dinwiddie said after the game that his running game was essentially going to be the same as it was a year ago. He doesn't have any different expectations because Ouellette is not there. And you mentioned Kadeem Carey looking really good. I also thought he took a little subtle shot at BC when he was talking about Vernon Adams Jr. and the Lions thinking that they're the number one team in the league. The key word there, thinking. I think the Argonauts showed that they still deserve to be up there competing with the best in the CFL and be talked about among the best teams, regardless, honestly, of whoever's at quarterback. Cameron Dukes came from a little known institution in the United States, had to play Arena League ball and then battle his way just to be able to be in a position to be one, I was going to say play away from being QB1 in the CFL, but I guess in this instance, one situation away from being QB1. So the Argos really impressed me for a number of reasons in week one.
I think that we are underappreciating how much Ryan Dinwiddie has done for the CFL in terms of quarterback development. If you go back 10 years ago, Scott Milanovich was the quarterback whisperer, not only obviously helped Ricky Ray have a resurgence in his career, but obviously helped set the groundwork for guys like Zach Collaros, guys like Trevor Harris. You go another 5 years down the road, a lot of people credited Dave Dickinson with being the quarterback guru, not only for helping develop Bo Levi Mitchell into the player that he was, but helping develop some of those other guys who came out of Calgary. Not a lot of them had like wild success elsewhere, but were certainly competent players in Cowtown. There's no question that the best coach in the CFL when it comes to developing quarterbacks right now is Ryan Dinwiddie, a guy who can take an unknown, unheralded, not particularly strong-armed guy out of the NAIA, not a top level of college football, and in just a couple years, turn him into a guy who can go out there against the BC Lions, throw for 3 touchdowns, no picks. I was extremely impressed with how Cameron Dukes responded after fumbling away, right, with T.O. Dubai scooping and scoring for the BC Lions. A lot of young quarterbacks will crumble when they allow a defensive touchdown like that. Cam Duke seemed to forget about it immediately and went out there, got points, and then and ended up winning the game by not a inconsiderable margin. Again, they won this game by 8 points, and that was even with BC getting that score on defense. JC, I think your answer to this question is wild and crazy, and I will tell you why. The Saskatchewan Roughriders, I was told during training camp and the preseason by everybody in Regina that this team had a brand new culture and they were going to be disciplined now because Corey Mace was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And the last I checked, Logan Ferland punched somebody in the face during this game. And I'm not suggesting that that is Corey Mace's fault, but if you're going to talk about being disciplined and being a new team that's turned over a leaf since being undisciplined under Craig Dickinson, we can't have people punching other people in the face. And I don't think that that is an unreasonable thing to suggest. I was also concerned that this team had to punt 9 times and they took 84 yards in penalties. Now, it was still good enough of a performance to beat the Edmonton Elks. And I was also impressed with how they rallied late. But overall, I was not impressed with this team. I think I need to see more. I think you're obviously encouraged with what Trevor Harris did. I was very, very impressed with how he responded from injury. The 3 touchdown passes were great, but he did also have a couple of picks. One of them, not his fault. The other probably was. But to me, I think the answer at the end of the day is the Montreal Alouettes. They came into Princess Auto Stadium where the Bombers were 31-3 since 2019. I've been in the press box in Winnipeg since 2019. That was the 4th game I've covered that was a loss, which is crazy. It is such a difficult place to win. Not only did the Alouettes win, they completely outclassed the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. And to me, they are rightfully the number one team in our power rankings. To me, that was the most impressive victory from the first week of the season.
And the thing about the Alouettes is that defense is just so solid and so good.
Unbelievable.
Right now, right? That stretch that they had to end last season where they were just unbeatable on the defensive side of the ball has clearly carried over into 2024 with much of the same guys returning and some interesting new additions. I know we're going to touch on it later in the 3-minute drill, but Reggie Stubblefield likely done for the year with a torn ACL. That should be a big loss, but you see Bryce Crosby in there for some of those packages, and he looks like a guy who could be similar to Reggie Stubblefield in the type of impact he could make as a rookie. So some really intriguing things going on with that Noel Thorpe defense. I think he's going to have it at the top of the league, up there contending with the Toronto Argonauts because their front 7 is absolutely insane as well. Those two are really going to duke it out in the East Division.
Just a note, fellas, before we move on, Cameron Dukes is from the football factory known as Lindsey Wilson College in Columbia, Kentucky. Has a population, you know, depends on the year, around 2,500 students. And let's give Cameron Dukes some credit for what he's done. Yes, Ryan Dinwiddie is really great with quarterbacks. Plus, also, I want to credit part of this, at least, to Rob Williams, who is a quarterback movement coach based out where you are, JC, in British Columbia. Dukes worked with him this offseason. Williams had rave reviews about him and vice versa for Dukes about Rob Williams. So a Canadian making him name for himself in pro football quarterback circles, Rob Williams, people need to pay attention to him. But Cam Dukes deserves some of the credit. Ryan Dinwiddie can't do it all for him.
And for the uninitiated, Rob Williams is the guy who took Nathan Rourke from a raw lump of clay with accuracy issues, a run-first quarterback from Ohio University, and turned him into the accurate passer that we know and love today. I'll say this on Cameron Dukes. I talked to a CFL scout this week, and a guy who has worked specifically with a lot of quarterbacks, NFL caliber quarterbacks, who knows his QBs. And he said, coming out of Lindsey Wilson Collegiate, he didn't think he was a guy, right? He put up a lot of numbers. He was a 3-time All-American. But he said, I didn't even think he was necessarily good enough to start at the top level in Europe. And then in arena ball, he was okay, not dominant. But this guy has, again, done the work over the last couple of years to get his fundamentals right. Going to Rob Williams is a big testament to that. And I think the CFL game fits him better, right? Because we see the way that he moves around. When you're playing at the NAIA level and you don't know what the competition is that a player is going against, that sort of stuff can get discounted because you say, well, yeah, he's fast, he's mobile, but he's playing against a bunch of scrubs, right? And then you go to arena ball and you're playing at a box and that can't really be showcased. Now you get up on the wide CFL field and you see just how slippery Cameron Dukes can be. Yes, he has the best offensive line in the league in front of him, but whenever there was even the slightest hint of pressure on him in that game, he was able to step up and out and escape and make plays with his feet. I think that's an element in Cameron Dukes' game that's been discounted his entire life just based on the situations that he's been in, and now it's being allowed to shine once he's made all the other corrections to his mechanics and stuff that come with dedicating yourself to training, both with the team with Ryan Dinwiddie and in the offseason with guys like Rob Williams.
The other thing that should be said about Dukes is he played for the Vegas Nighthawks, and their head coach and general manager is Mike Davis, who's been in the CFL for a number of years. And I know he was a big proponent of Dukes getting up to the CFL because he has a chance to make more money than he does or could have in the Arena League, I should say, and felt like he would fit. So sometimes it ends up being, you know, a lot of people in your favor or chance kind of happenstance stuff. But, you know, I feel like Cameron Dukes has helped himself with the way that he's approached the situation as well.
The CFL is returning to CTV for the first time since 1986, as Saturday games will be broadcast on the network throughout the fall at 3 p.m., plus the East semifinal, East final, and the Grey Cup. Is that a big deal, a little deal, or no deal?
None of the above. It's a massive deal, and I'll give you an example, all right? Not that this is the case now, but you guys joke about, you know, my inconsistent sometimes farm internet. When I was a kid growing up on the farm, you guys know it, we only had a handful of channels that we could get literally over the rabbit ears. And you know, people joke about this kind of stuff, but you'd have to like hold it in a specific spot to make sure that that channel wouldn't go fuzzy. And we got a lot of Buffalo Bills games, so those were, you know, kind of my first memories of football. But also some of those first memories were watching the CFL on CBC, Doug Flutie doing his thing in particular, and it was because it was, I think the term is, over the air. So not that, you know, the internet hasn't spread and, you know, Elon Musk with Starlink or Rogers or Bell in this country haven't tried to get internet out to every nook and cranny around our borders, but there are still areas in this country where it's not easily accessible to get fast enough internet to stream these games. And the other part of it is just the open access to it, that it comes in free over the air, that you don't have to pay, you know, whatever it costs to get the TSN subscription just to watch the CFL games. I think this can draw in a bigger audience. And I just know from my own experience being back on the farm that, you know, my fingers were crossed for as many games as could potentially be seen on CBC or the CBS Buffalo channel that we happen to get in rural Guelph, and on for, you know, a number of sports, but I'll just stick to football for it right now. So this is absolutely a massive deal. It's a great game to start this off. It's going to be at the 3 p.m. Eastern time window. It's going to be the Banjo Bowl, Riders at Bombers, which should draw a large TV number. We know the Labor Day Classic is usually the most watched game in the Canadian Football League's regular season schedule. I think the Banjo Bowl being on CTV as well can produce a big number, and it helps the CFL get their brand out. So however this came together behind the scenes with Bell Media, TSN, and CTV, kudos to finally getting it done. It almost doesn't seem real that this actually has happened.
Yeah, I remember sitting on the show probably about a year ago. I could maybe dig up the clip, I don't know. But
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Suggestion to the league was in the fall on Saturdays. You can't do Sundays because that's NFL Sunday. On Saturdays, create football night in Canada or football day in Canada. It's before the NHL gets going, and just have a game on at the same time every day nationally on CTV where everybody can watch it. And thank you, CFL, for using my idea. I don't know if somebody else had it before me. It's fine. I don't expect credit or compensation, though you know where to find me if you want to send me an e-transfer. But this is brilliant. Food. Or some food. I'll accept money or any cuisine, really. I'm not picky. This was a brilliant decision. The Grey Cup has been happening for well over a century. It is woven into the fabric of our nation. And though I respect the fact that TSN pays reportedly in the neighborhood of $50 million a year to be the exclusive broadcast partner of the CFL on television, I also think that putting that type of national event behind a paywall where you either need to have cable or pay a not insignificant amount of money for a monthly, fee access to TSN Direct or TSN Plus or TSN Live, or whatever the heck they even call it now, is in a way wrong, right? If you are a Canadian, I think that watching the Grey Cup in a way is your right. It is our history. It is our collective experience. And we are a relatively young country. There's not many things in Canada that you can say. This is a time-honored tradition that's been around for well over 100 years. There's a very small handful of things, right, that are like that. The Grey Cup is one of them. So I'm thrilled that anybody who wants to watch the Grey Cup can do so now. And yes, this is taking away some of the exclusivity that TSN has paid for. With that being said, they're going to get more eyeballs on their broadcast. And this is going to be great exposure for the CFL. Like, the CFL has been exclusively with TSN, a paid cable channel, for I believe it's 18 years now, maybe 17 years, since 2007, I think, is when they went exclusive. So if you are somebody who does not have cable, you've probably forgot that the CFL even exists, right? You're not watching CFL games. Maybe you catch the occasional one at a sports bar, something like that. But
except for the playoffs or the Grey Cup, because it has been on CTV.
Some of those years, it wasn't on CTV last year.
I think it has been in recent years. We'd have to double check, but I think the Grey Cup has been on CTV.
I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. We'd have to check. I don't think that's accurate. But regardless, getting regular season games, making it at a consistent time, which is friendly for fans across the country, I think is super smart. I'm very interested to see how the numbers look. And as our listeners know, 3Down exclusively reports the CFL's television ratings every week. So I'm very curious to see if the proof will be in the pudding. I'm happy to eat my words if the ratings don't go up, but I strongly suspect they will.
Yeah, that's the fascination I have with this move, is we've spent a lot of time, not just us, but anyone who talks about the CFL, moaning and complaining that these games aren't on CTV and how viewership would go up exponentially if it was. Well, now we have a chance to see that in action. We've got a regular time slot. We've got games for several weeks on that channel. Is it going to have a massive positive impact in ratings? I think it will, but we are going to see firsthand what impact that has. And I have seen a little bit of criticism online when this news was announced that, hey, why is it just the East semifinal, or why is it just the East final? Shouldn't you be carrying all the playoffs? How dare you not carry everything? Let's take some baby steps, right? Hopefully we get to that point. Hopefully the ratings prove that the CFL is a valuable commodity, that Bell Media should tell their subsidiary TSN to be like, hey, to make this even more valuable for you, get it on our other subsidiary, CTV. Let's work together on this more often. Let's get more games on that free network. But we don't know that yet because we haven't seen the evidence. We haven't seen the numbers. This is a good start. Where there's nothing to criticize here. The league has taken initiative on an issue that fans have had for years. They've made progress here. I think it is a win all around for the CFL to have these games on that network, and I can't wait to see the results.
Just really quick.
You guys could be right, last, I think.
The last time that the Grey Cup was on network free television, according to Wikipedia, it was 2007. And that was the last year it was on CBC. The 96th Grey Cup in 2008, Calgary Stampeders going to Montreal, upset the Alouettes, was exclusively on TSN and TSN HD. And in the States, it was on Versus. The French language broadcast was also on RDS. The American rights have bounced around all over the place. Last year's Grey Cup was exclusively on CFL Plus internationally. But I don't believe it's been on network television since 2008, which, like, JC, were you even born? Like, come on.
I can remember that Grey Cup, okay? I'm not that young. I'm young. I was still, like, oh, what was I? I was 11 or 12 at that stage, sitting around the kitchen table. I think I had my grandparents over. That was the Grey Cup where Duval missed the field goal, wasn't it?
I don't actually... Are you talking about the 13th man game?
No.
I don't remember if Duvall missed one in 2008, but in 2009, he certainly missed one. The Stamps won 22-14, so this would not have been a last minute. The reason I remember the 2008 Grey Cup is because John Huffnagel gave arguably the greatest pregame speech in the history of sports, which if you haven't watched, please YouTube it. It's amazing. I won't even try to copy it here. Just watch it for yourself. It's fantastic.
Sergio Castillo ripped the CFL for using microchipped footballs in the kicking game during Winnipeg's loss to Montreal. He was supported by a number of kickers around the league. One day later, the league responded to the outcry by giving teams an option to use non-chipped footballs in the kicking game for the rest of the season as more testing is done for 2025. Did Castillo speak the truth, or is he just being a whiner?
I think that Sergio spoke the truth. I think if he was a rookie who came in and was the only one having problems and nobody had his back, he'd rightfully be labeled a whiner. But this is a guy who's been in the CFL for almost a decade. He set a team record for single-season field goal percentage just last year with over 90% of his kicks made. And I was the first one to Sergio's locker after the game finished on Thursday, and basically he threw up his arms and he ushered in the media and he said, all right, come on, I've got something to say, basically. And he was blowing the whistle for an issue that CFL kickers had quietly behind the scenes been petitioning the league about for weeks. Essentially, the USFL used microchipped footballs in 2021 for the first 2 weeks of the season, went away from it because the chip was wreaking havoc on the kicking game. And the way I've had it explained to me is the microchip is located beside the laces of the football, which means that when the ball is spinning in a spiral motion, like when it's thrown, the weight is negated. It's just evenly distributed as the ball spins. When the ball is kicked end over end, like on a field goal or a kickoff, or in some cases even a punt, the weight is not evenly distributed because the ball is not spinning in that spiral motion. It's traveling end over end. And so if the chip is on the right side of the football, it tends to lean that way. If the ball is on the left side of the football, it tends to lean that way. And again, there were uncharacteristic misses from Sergio in that game. He missed a 38-yard field goal, a 40-yard field goal, missed a convert. David Cote of the Alouettes missed a convert. I had some people saying, well, David Cote made all of his field goals. Well, his field goals were from under 20 yards. Yeah, he made them. They were substantially shorter than even convert attempts. So kudos to the CFL for making this change very quickly after Sergio and a number of kickers, including Lewis Ward, you know, a guy who holds the single season CFL record for field goal percentage, guys like Sean White, a former most outstanding special teams player, a guy like Brett Lothar, who is also the vice president of the Canadian Football League Players Association, speaking out. You just wish that they'd listen to the kicker sooner, because we don't need chip balls on kicking plays. We don't. I would imagine the league wants it for data purposes, right? With their data partner, Genius Sports, you know, maybe there's a big return. They want to know, okay, how fast was the returner running at his top speed, whatever. But first and foremost, we need the integrity of the game to be at hand. And fortunately, it seems as though the integrity of the league and this game has been fixed after only one game. You just wish that it didn't cost Sergio a nasty performance. It didn't cost Winnipeg the game. Winnipeg was losing that game either way, but it certainly caused him undue stress, I would say.
I will say this. In an issue such as this, the league has come out and said there's no definitive evidence that the chip affects the flight of the football on field goals. And to be frank, I am skeptical that it has as much of an impact as the kickers say it do. It does. But when you've got all nine guys across the league saying the same thing, it doesn't matter if it's real or not, right? It's real in their mind, and it has an effect on the way they're performing, and they're not comfortable. So a change had to be made here. Should it have been made sooner? Absolutely. The second that this was raised in training camp, the second that you had that many people speaking out against it and the union involved, it should have been kiboshed before it ever got to week one. But the league made the right decision after this got out there because of Castillo to cancel it for the rest of the week. I know Castillo believes that all his misses were contributed to by that chip. We saw other kickers throughout the week with bad misses. You talked about Boris Beattie off the top, the only miss worse than Sergio Castillo. There's no chips in those footballs, so kickers are going to miss sometimes, and I'm not sure how much that microchip, that 5 ounces, is actually going to affect that kick in and kick out. But there are two positions in sports that are unique from a mental aspect, and that's hockey goalies and football kickers. You have to be a special type of individual to handle that pressure. You have to be a special type of creature of habit. And when you throw it off even a little bit, there are effects to the outcome. We saw it in the USFL. We saw it in week one. I'm glad that this is now out of the way, whether or not there's actually definitive evidence that it affects the football in any manner.
There's an easy way to figure out if this is affecting the kickers mentally. Give them some footballs with chips in them. Give them some footballs without chips in them. Have them kick them and then see if they can actually tell you which footballs have chips in them. Problem solved. The reason that I thought that there was an issue was from watching, I believe it was Sergio Castillo's first miss, but I mean, obviously there were a couple of them in that game, and he just shrugged and walked to the sideline, wasn't upset, had a conversation that you could see on camera that TSN caught as he was walking over there with Mike O'Shea. And it was almost as if he was, I don't say okay with missing the field goal, because he's not trying to miss it, but just the way that O'Shea described, that he hit it cleanly, there was nothing else that he can do to try to get that ball through the uprights. That made me think, like, you know, this isn't normal behavior from Sergio Castillo, right? If he would have missed a kick, he might have been genuinely upset. He might have been talking with O'Shea or going over there and kind of tweaking his form on the kick. But that's when I started to think, okay, that's just unusual from Castillo. And, you know, it turns out, as Hodge said, he kind of invited the media in to his locker and gave his side of the story. So perhaps there actually is something to it, but until there's more data gathered here, whether the chips are involved or not in the footballs that these guys kick, then we're not going to know for sure. But I really would like to see the kickers kicking with balls that they don't know if there's a chip in it or not and potentially go from there. I don't necessarily think, though, that the data you're going to capture from a kick is relevant. Like, are people actually interested in that kind of a kind of data? Not. I don't think so.
I will say this. I don't know. I didn't get official confirmation of what the weight of the chip is. JC, you said it's 5 ounces. Again, I can't verify that's accurate. Would you like to know how many loonies that is equivalent from a weight standpoint?
Sure. I have no idea how big 5 ounces is. I think I heard that from one of the kickers.
That is the weight of 20 loonies. So if you can imagine, a loony is 7 grams. 1 ounce
There's no way it's that heavy.
I don't think so either. But the point is, even if it is just 1 ounce, that would be the weight of 4 loonies. If you can imagine 4 loonies inserted to one side of a football, obviously it's going to pull to one side. And again, we don't know the official weight. I will say Castillo was able to tell the difference between the two balls during training camp, because he said when using the chipped balls, he said 60% was a good day. When using the regular balls, he was 90% like normal. And I will also say, I've known Sergio. I mean, this is his third stint in the CFL, third stint with the Blue Bombers since coming to the CFL. He's kicked at the NFL level. He's not a complainer. He is not a whiner. He is as happy-go-lucky as I've ever seen a player. And again, there are some guys in the CFL, if they were speaking out and whining and complaining, you kind of roll your eyes and go, oh, so-and-so's whining again. You could set your watch to that. Sergio's not that guy. He's not. And to a player, to a man, that is accurate. So I fully believe him. Are the kickers overblowing it a little bit? I think that's possible. But I think that anybody who's writing this off as a non-issue is not giving these guys enough credit. And I will also say, Sergio did say, yes, the league said that testing was done. However, not a single CFL kicker was involved in that testing. And he seemed to indicate that it wasn't even done by professionals. So I don't know who did the testing, but one would think CFL kickers should have been involved in that.
Absolutely. No.
Missing these kicks could cost guys a job. You could lose your job.
Absolutely could. Yeah. And just a quick note, because I don't think it was clear in your last comments, and Dunk mentioned the blind test. When Castillo is saying he was 60% with the chips and 90% without, he did know which footballs were chipped and which were not. So that was not a blind test. Those were days when, hey, we're kicking the chipped footballs, and he's off on that entire day.
Well,
and then he brings in the unchipped footballs, and he has a successful day. Right?
I don't know that. It's possible he was kicking them blind, and then then an equipment guy told him after the fact, yeah, those were all chipped, or like, oh yeah, those were all not chipped. I don't know. I do know that he said the chipped balls were not used during their first preseason game in Regina, specifically because the kickers didn't want to use them. The chip balls were used the second preseason game when Winnipeg hosted Calgary, in a game that I've blocked out of my memory because it was the worst CFL game I've ever watched in my entire life. But point is, we don't have to deal with these chips for now. Hopefully by 2025, the CFL will empower its kickers to practice with these things, make proper testing and observations about what's going on with these balls.
Yeah, surely just having equivalent counterweight, right? Like, chip one side, make it balanced. Like, there's got to be some way.
I think they should put a perfect row of chips all the way around the ball.
Could work.
Light it up. I just want to say real quick, guys, you know, Randy Ambrosi's out here talking about the integrity of the game when it comes to gambling and Sean Lemon, and rightfully so. But where's the integrity of the game with this issue? If you say there was testing done, show us the data. Tell us about the testing. We're talking about the football that's actually being played with, fellas. Like, think of other sports, right? Baseball, tennis, golf. If there was a little bit of a weight added to any of those balls, of course it's going to change the shape of it. And look at all the data, you know, specifically in tennis and golf. I mean, even to some degree in baseball, that they can glean from that without touching the ball that's used on every single shot. So I just would like the CFL to understand here that you start playing with the football and you want to talk about integrity of the game, that this is affecting the integrity of it, because Hodge, as you laid out, yes, it didn't necessarily affect the scoreline in Winnipeg because it was a close game, but we're looking at that game after 60 minutes, right? If Sergio Castillo hits those kicks, perhaps the momentum for the Bombers is indifferent, and that overall game is completely different. And then we're talking about the Bombers and Alouettes having to play with those chipped footballs from a kicking standpoint for one game, and the rest of the league having the actual choice to do so or not. So you want to talk about integrity of game. We're talking about the footballs that are played with on every single play. And, you know, I've never thrown a chipped football in my life, but I can imagine being a former university quarterback. I know you guys hate me referring to this, but if you put a chip in there and started, you know, telling me about it, that even in my head, I would start to think, okay, you know, is there something different about this? Do I throw better with it? Do I throw worse with it? What's going on? Because ultimately, these guys have careers on the line and they want to be in the CFL, the majority of them, for as long as possible or as long as their bodies hold up. So let's get this right. And I would challenge the league that it was great they made this decision so quickly to change it in a day. That's rare for the CFL to be that quick on its feet. But I want to see and hear about the testing that was done, if it even happened. That's pure speculation, but show us.
Well, they could have saved this entire like PR disaster by just making this decision slightly earlier so that it didn't impact the regular season. The kick, according to Sergio, the kickers were not informed, I would assume through the CFLPA, that chip balls would be used in the kicking game until Wednesday. Like literally one day before the start of the regular season. That is how late it came. And so if you make the like you eventually made what I think was the correct decision anyway. I have no idea why you wouldn't just make that decision 48 hours earlier to save yourself this whole rigmarole. Because it's clear the kickers wanted to go through the proper channels, right? They were not blowing up the CFL about this publicly a month ago. They waited until it actually affected a game. So anyways, I do believe the kickers in this instance. And again, I think you look at the body of work for a guy like Sergio, the fact that he's not a complainer, the fact that his kicks were awful, and the fact that he had all the kickers in the league essentially backing him up. I fully believe him on this issue. I'm not skeptical about this at all.
Time to make our picks for week two in the Canadian Football League. You boys both went 2-2 against the spread last week, so I'm expecting better. Let's be winners, boys, okay? This time around, make the people some money. The Blue Bombers are 6.5-point favorites against the Red Blacks, who play for the first time this season following a week one bye. Drew Brown, who spent the past three seasons in the Peg, makes his first start as Ottawa's QB1. Well, the Bombers are without all-star receiver Kenny Lawler and the reigning most outstanding Canadian, Brady Oliveira. Hodge, you got burned by Winnipeg last week. Are you taking the Bombers against the spread again?
No, and the reason for that is what you just mentioned. Brady Oliveira will not play due to a knee injury. I think Johnny Augustine is an underrated player, but he is certainly no Brady Oliveira. And when you look at Winnipeg's receiving core, they've got Carrick Wheatfall making his first career start in place of Kenny Lawler. You've got Ontario Wilson making his second career start in Rashid Bailey's old spot. This is a skeleton crew. Now, one of these guys could step up, but it is tough to, after seeing a poor offensive performance last week with some of these weapons in tow, imagining Winnipeg having a strong day on the offensive side of the ball. That being said, I am still going to take them to win. I got big questions about Ottawa's offensive line. I've got questions about how quickly Drew Brown, though I am a fan of his game, he'll be able to hit the ground running with a new team. So I will take Winnipeg to win. However, I will take the Red Blacks to cover.
I'm in exactly the same boat as you are, Hodge, which based on last week means you guys at home should pick exactly the opposite of what we're saying here. But I don't trust the Bombers without that many star players in their lineup. I think there's going to be a bounce back team. I do not think that a Mike O'Shea-led team can come out flat 2 weeks in a row. We've seen the Bombers stumble before, and they've always, always had a bounce back game. I think they will have that here, but they just don't have the same ammunition that they're used to having around Zach Collaros right now. And I think that gives just enough for an improved Ottawa team to cover this very large spread here at home.
To me, the points in this one is a smart play, fellas, you know, kind of like they were in those two games that I was giving Hodge the business about in week one. The Red Blacks are at home. Yes, it's a prime bounce back spot for Winnipeg, and I do think they probably win, and Michael Shea's record in these kinds of situations would prove it. But there's a lot of energy around that team. I think Darius Pickett has brought a new attitude and physicality to that defense. The offensive line definitely has to play better, but you know, I do think it is a prime spot for the Red Blacks to have a decent chance to cover and maybe make Hodge look like a fool yet again for eating a bunch of points.
I'm not eating the points. I'm taking the points.
You are? Oh, I thought you were laying them with Winnipeg.
No, I'm picking Winnipeg straight up. I'm taking Red Blacks against the spread, and you got to listen better, buddy.
Oh, jeez. What am I doing? Sorry, dude. Need to clean out my earwax.
It's okay, Dustin. It happens all the time.
Yeah, call me whatever you want. I'm just a little wiener. It doesn't bother me. The Edmonton Elks are 5.5-point underdogs. We'll try to listen better this time around, I promise. Against the reigning Grey Cup champion Montreal Alouettes, who pasted the Blue Bombers in Winnipeg last week. Cody Fajardo threw 2 touchdown passes in the win, while Noel Thorpe's defense held Winnipeg without a touchdown for 59 minutes. Meanwhile, the Elks coughed up a 13-point fourth quarter in a comedy of errors that led to Saskatchewan winning late in that game, overcoming a 21-8 deficit to score 21 answered and win 29-21 on the road, handing the Elks a loss. JC, do you see Edmonton dropping to 0-2?
I really do, and it's unfortunate for that franchise as a whole, one that myself and my family hold very close to our hearts being from Edmonton, but I just don't see a way that they win this football team. That team is not galvanized right now. They're improved on offense. I liked some of the progress. I liked what I saw from McLeod Bethel-Thompson in his first start for Edmonton, but this Montreal defense is legit. Nobody has beat up on them since halfway through last season, and the Edmonton Elks are not going to be the first to do that. They're going to struggle more offensively here, and they just don't have the defense to stop even Montreal's more conservative offense. I think this is not going to be particularly close, and I'm taking the Alouettes and all the points.
To me, I think if you look at the win Montreal had last week, that is their formula to a T. They are going to suffocate you on defense. They are going to play close to flawless special teams, and they're going to be opportunistic on offense, right? Cody Fajardo finished that game with about 250 passing yards. 76 of them came on a trick play, right, with the flea flicker to Tyson Philpott. I think that is the formula they're going to use all season, and I do have them winning this game, but I do think that Edmonton, just like the Riders, fought back late in last week's game. I think the Edmonton Elks could get some garbage time points here to keep this one within one score. I don't think it's easy to win back-to-back games on the road, which is exactly what the Alouettes are going to have to do here. So I will take the Alouettes to win. However, at +5.5, I will take the Edmonton Elks to cover at home.
That's a smart pick, in my opinion, Hodge. You touched on it. Not just back-to-back games on the road, back-to-back games on the road in the West Division, flying a good chunk of our beautiful country. And I think that the Sharps are going to be on the Elks in this game, and that's usually where you want to side with your money. So I think Edmonton makes a lot of sense for a number of reasons, you know, outside them Elksing from time to time or Elksing a bunch of times in the fourth quarter, that's probably the smart play in this ballgame. The BC Lions are 8.5-point favorites over the Calgary Stampeders for their home opener in Vancouver, which will feature a pregame performance from rap icon 50 Cent. I'm going shine till my heart don't stop. The Lions got off to a disappointing start last week in Toronto, allowing 6 sacks and a loss to the Argonauts, while the Stampeders beat Hamilton despite having to settle for 6 field goals from Rene Paradis. Hodge, does Calgary stand a chance in what will be very hostile territory?
Well, 50 Cent has 21 questions, and they're all about BC's offensive line. This unit struggled terribly, particularly at the left guard spot in their season opening loss to the Toronto Argonauts. I think that this is a ton of points. I do have the Lions winning this one, but with an improved secondary in Cowtown and the offensive line that I think was doing a really nice job controlling the line of scrimmage, opening holes for BJ Emmons and Dedrick Mills, I think that the Calgary Stampeders will keep this one close. I also liked what we saw from a more fleet-footed Jake Mayer, who helped take the pressure off that club's 2 relatively inexperienced offensive tackles in moving the pocket, shifting around the launch point. I do think that this crowd is going to be a big factor in this one. The Lions are expecting over 50,000 people for a regular season game for the first time since 2011. Could be the largest crowd for a regular season game in decades. So I think that that will be a big advantage for the Leos. The Stampeders haven't played in front of that many people since the 2018 Grey Cup, and they're not used to playing in a facility anywhere close to what they're going to have in the dome at BC Place Stadium. So I will take the Lions to win, but I am unwilling to eat this many points. If you can get Calgary plus more than a touchdown, I think that is the spot on the line here.
Yeah, the BC Lions may have a lot of questions around their offensive line, but they've got more than 50,000 reasons to win this game. And I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but in a year when you're trying to increase your ticket sales yet again and build up momentum for a Vancouver Grey Cup and get people into that building for that showcase, you've got to win when you've got 50,000 people in the building. The pressure is on the Lions, but they've got Vernon Adams Jr., who, despite all those problems with his protection, looked really good in the opener. And I don't think Calgary's line, while it's good, is going to be quite at the level that Toronto's was, where they're too deep at every position with guys who would start on other teams. The line is going to be able to buy VA just slightly more time, and the Lions are going to be able to get it done here. I just don't think they cover this spread. I am not confident enough in this team right now to take all those points, much like you, Hodge. So take the Stamps to cover, but take the Lions to win.
You know, this week feels to me like that famous meme that goes around on the internet where the guy's walking down the street with his girlfriend holding his hand, and he's looking at the girl that just went by. Last week, he was holding the hand of his girlfriend, eating up all those points, nom, nom, nom. But this week, he's looking at that girl walking by saying, yeah, I don't need these points. I just want the spoils that go to the victor, and I'll wait for my dessert. So I like this change from Hodge, because I feel like in this spot, it makes a lot of sense. Excuse me. There's a lot of pressure on BC at home. I do think the Lions are in a great spot here to get a win. But having that many people in the building with 50 and everything, everybody's expecting BC to win. Nobody's expecting anything from Calgary. That oftentimes is a recipe for potential disaster, or at least a loss in this case. And you look at the points here, and I think the public is playing up everything that's going on with BC and having 50 Cent there, but the Sharps are going to be on Calgary's side. So I think it's smart to take the points with the Stamps in this game. The Hamilton Tiger Cats are short favorites at home against the Saskatchewan Roughriders on Sunday, where the Ticats will look to get their first win of the season. Bo Levi Mitchell showed surprising mobility in last week's loss to Calgary. Those receivers did drop a number of passes. The Roughriders, meanwhile, completed a late comeback against Edmonton to start 1-0 as Sean Bain Jr. tied a single-game franchise record with, count them, 3 touchdown receptions. JC, who you got?
Well, I think this game, like so many others with the Hamilton Tiger Cats, is going to come down to QB play. And there will be a tendency to look at what the Ticats did in week one and look at how Bo Levi Mitchell seemed to find some rejuvenated energy, some mobility, and say, okay, I'm comfortable betting on that guy at home right now. But I think there's going to be a regression to the mean. That Bo Levi Mitchell that we saw in his return to Calgary was emotionally fired up for a big game that meant a lot to him. I think we see some regression to the mean here, more of the Bo that we've seen in the last couple years. And I just don't trust the Ticats' weapons as a whole, especially with how many drops that they had in week one, which ultimately cost them those games. I've talked about how impressed I was with the Riders battling back in that first game. I think coming on the road here in Hamilton, they're going to be able to do something similar and sneak out a victory with that offense that I think looks much improved. I'm taking the Saskatchewan Roughriders here.
I am going to be taking the hometown Hamilton Tiger Cats plus 1.5. Very short home favorites here. But I liked what I saw from Bo Levi Mitchell. Had he not suffered those drops from his receivers, he would have had close to 400 yards, which I can't remember the last time Bo Levi Mitchell had 400 yards in a game. Probably that's going back to the 2017-2018 heyday of Bo Levi Mitchell in Cowtown. I think the Riders are a better team than they were last year, but I think that that late resurgence we saw from them against Edmonton hid a lot of warts and a lot of bruises from that performance. I did not like the lack of discipline that Logan Ferland demonstrated. I didn't like how many offensive drives stalled from that team. I think Hamilton's defensive line is at least as good as the Edmonton Elks is. All those pieces that they added from the rival Toronto Argonauts, guys like Brandon Barlow, Dwayne Hendricks, Casey Sales, I think is finally starting to get his flowers as somebody who's been underrated in this league for a while. So I'm happy to take the Tabbies. Though, I will say this is the first half of a home and home between these two teams. I think these guys are going to split the home and home regardless. So I'm happy to take the Tabbies this week and the Riders in week three when they play at Mosaic. I just really hope that I don't take Hamilton this week, Sask, in week three, and they do the old reverse around where Saskatchewan wins this week and the Ticats win week three. I will be very distraught and annoyed if that happens. But for now, I'm rolling with the Ticats at home. Next week, I will roll with the Riders at home.
I like that you guys are on both sides of this game because it could be that close. That said, as Joel Gasson wrote in his column, JC mentioned it earlier, the process in Ryderville seems like it's much better. The physicality of that team, I think, is at a better level. The energy is there as well. I think those penalties last week were selfish penalties that can be addressed. Trevor Reed taking an unnecessary roughness penalty. Obviously, Logan Ferland. And there was one from Jaden Dahlke that was taunting away from the play. Those kind of things, I think, can be cleaned up. And yes, Trevor Harris threw a couple interceptions in that game, but Keen Schaefer Baker slipped on one, and the other, Sean Bain Jr., was streaking for another big play, potentially another touchdown, and Harris simply underthrew that ball. He'll definitely own that mistake, but I think the Riders are just a better team that I would feel more confident with in this spot. That said, for them, they're going on the road for a second straight week. And even though it's not a West Division team, I think that's going to be difficult to come out East and play the Ticats in their home opener.
It's now time for Hodges' Heritage Moment. On this day in 2017, the Hamilton Tiger Cats signed quarterback Logan Kilgore following a stint with the Toronto Argonauts, during which he threw 2 touchdowns and 10 picks. The Middle Tennessee State product didn't last long in Steeltown, but later resurfaced in Edmonton, where he threw 6 touchdown passes and 9 interceptions in 2019, while Trevor Harris was out with a shoulder injury. Logan Kilgore's tenure in the CFL is perhaps best remembered for the oral injury in Edmonton, as his tongue bled profusely following a hit from Odell Willis in that 2019 season. He has since made the successful transition to the coaching ranks and now works as a quality control coach with the Denver Broncos. And it's unclear if he ever suffers terrible bloody tongue injuries in that role with the NFL team.
God.
Guys, I'm curious. We'll start with Dunk. How do you do with blood? Do you faint at the sight of it? Are you okay with it?
Bro, if we keep talking about it, I'm going to faint. Okay, I got a quick story. I warned my surgeon when I was going in for my second hernia surgery while I was playing football at, yes, the University of Guelph, that if we talk drink. About needles and surgery and blood, yeah, you're right. You probably should have a drink every time I say it. I'm going to pass out. And I told the surgeon specifically multiple times, and then, you know, predictably what happened, I passed out. And he was like, you know, I didn't really believe what you were saying. And I'm like, well, do you think I would want to make this up, man? Like, come on. So if we talk about blood for much longer, literally you're going to hear a bang because my mic is going to hit the floor and maybe my head too.
I'll say this. I'm not a fan of blood, but I can tolerate blood more than I can like internal bone or joint injuries. When something's dislocated and out of position, that really wigs me out and always has. I remember being on a water polo team when I was a really little kid and a girl falling in dry land training while we were running around and dislocating her kneecap. And my first thought that popped into my mind was, are we going to have to put her down now? Like she was a horse that had broken its leg.
Oh my goodness.
So I do not mess with dislocated anything. I can deal with blood though.
Bro, you're burying the lead though. Hold up. JC played water polo?
As
like, sink like a stone?
Hey, I'm a good swimmer, my guy. I'm a good swimmer. I haven't swam in a while, but I'm a good swimmer.
I won't make any whale jokes because that would be hurtful if somebody did that to me. So I will refrain from doing the same for you.
Hodge, how do you do with blood?
I would say like middle of the road, like it doesn't horribly offend me, but like would I opt for blood? No. If I got to deal with it, I can. It's not something I gravitate towards. I would not. I would probably not do well in the medical field. But that's more of like a germs thing. I don't like germs. I'm cool, like okay-ish with blood. I don't like germs.
So if a piece of your food dropped on the floor or a field, you wouldn't eat it?
I got a dog, so no, of course not.
Okay. Just checking. Let's go to the 3-minute drill, fellas. Hodge, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers will be without star receiver Kenny Lawler for the foreseeable future, as he's reportedly suffered an arm fracture that's landed him on the 6-game injured list. How big of a loss is that?
It's huge. I mean, Dalton Schoen gets a lot of ink, a lot of attention in Bomberland, and I think that he is great as a deep threat, as a guy who can find the hole in the zone on second down. But Kenny Lawler is the guy who busts man coverage and has, I think, the widest catch radius in the CFL. That is an extremely quarterback-friendly thing to have. The Bombers are going to miss him badly. The Ottawa Redblacks have immortalized 2-time CFL All-Star center John Gott with a bobblehead depicting his viral beer chug. Are you going to buy one?
Absolutely. Come on. This is the coolest piece of CFL memorabilia that I've come across in recent years. If you don't have one of these in your collection, are you a real CFL fan? Come on. This was the best celebration. It's going to be the best piece in my collection. The Edmonton Elks unveiled new uniforms to commemorate their 75th anniversary season. Just one point. Yuck. Since you've seen them on the field, do you give these UEs a thumbs up or a thumbs down like I do?
I liked your word. 2 thumbs down. These jerseys just don't do it for me. I really thought there was going to be a cool, fresh look on the double E logo. That didn't happen. I don't know what's going on the shoulders of these jerseys or what significance that's supposed to have. I do think, though, that they got some things right in terms of the numbers popping out with the color and the way that they've done that. But overall, man, these jerseys just ain't doing it for me. Montreal Alouettes strong side linebacker Reggie Stubblefield revealed on social media he suffered a torn ACL in Thursday's win over Winnipeg. Will the Owls miss him in the lineup?
They will. And look, I would never in a million years cheer for a player to get hurt, but it should be noted that on the play right before Stubblefield pulled up lame on a non-contact injury, he was seen trying to violently twist the ankle of Chris Streveler, who was down on the field. Now, Stubblefield, to his credit, denied trying to injure Chris Streveler. Chris Streveler was extremely upset about it after the game, said there was no place for it. I'm not going to go as far as to call it karma or justice, but I do think that, you know, any injury sucks, but we can't have guys out here twisting ankles. It's just not appropriate. The Edmonton Elks have inducted longtime equipment manager Dwayne Mandrusiak into the team's builder's wall. Is he a worthy selection?
I don't think there's any person in the city of Edmonton in its history that is a more worthy selection for a builder's wall with the Edmonton Elks than Dwayne Mandrusiak. This guy, for 49 years, was the heart and the soul of this organization, the keeper of its history and legacy. And it is no surprise that when they let him unceremoniously out of the door, they ushered him out, that this team went to hell in a handbasket. Hopefully bringing him a little bit more into the fold, honoring him in this way, will help fix some of that bad karma. The Saskatchewan Roughriders posted a net loss of $1.1 million in 2023. Dunk, should that give Rider Nation a reason to panic?
I don't think so. The team reported positive earnings of $1.5 million before interest and depreciation, and the team has assets of $49 million with a stabilization fund that has grown to $9.6 million. Ideally, would they like to be making millions of dollars every year, but I think there is, from a non-accountant, some creative accountant going on here. And the Riders, from an overall standpoint, I think are in a great spot, especially considering Corey Mace mania going crazy in Riderville. The Toronto Argonauts have released former CFL All-Star defensive tackle Sean Oakman. Why do you think the Double Blue let him go?
Well, I mean, Jared Brinkman was sensational in week one. Jake Ceresna is obviously fantastic. And clearly they like what they have in Jordan Williams, who is a rookie defensive tackle, not to be confused with the Canadian linebacker of the same name who retired this offseason. Oakman was a healthy scratch at one point last season. But I would imagine there's something more going on behind the scenes here. That said, I don't think Oakman should be a free agent for long. There are a lot of teams who could use his services. Université de Montréal quarterback Jonathan Senecal has been named the male U Sports Athlete of the Year. Do you think he'll be playing in the CFL next season, JC?
I certainly hope he gets a shot of some kind. There are some concerns about Senecal. He's a little bit skinny. I know he's drawn comparison to Trey Ford at times because he's mobile. I don't think he's quite as quick as Ford, but he's certainly got all of the tools, and he deserves a shot at the very least to be in a CFL camp and to develop for a little bit at the professional level because he has those physical tools to do it. Dunk, the CFL averaged 473,700 English language viewers in week one, a 22% leap from last year's opening slate. Is that an encouraging sign for TSN and the league?
It definitely is, you know, considering the Edmonton Oilers are trying to win the Stanley Cup and are at least in the final. I do think, you know, arguably the best thing that's happened to the CFL in 2024 is the Blue Jays not being, at least to this point, a very good team, perhaps drawing some attention away from them to the Canadian Football League. But I think the major correction here was the league actually having a tasty matchup for football fans around the country for that season opening game. I thought that really helped. That was the highest rated game of the week when you add in the RDS rating as well. The Blue Bombers have signed linebackers Tony Jones, who's an American, and Bailey Feltmate, a Canadian, to the team's practice roster. Will those two help solidify Winnipeg's defense?
Well, interestingly, Bailey Feltmate is dressing for the game against Ottawa as a fullback. He played a little bit of fullback with the Hamilton Tiger Cats after being a second-round pick out of the University of Acadia, with Michael Kreseik, Winnipeg's second-round pick this year, going from fullback to backing up Johnny Augustine at running back. So he'll make an immediate impact, and I think Tony Jones could absolutely make an impact. I think he's an excellent linebacker. He got cut, I think, largely due to the fact that Edmonton used the first overall pick in this year's draft on Joel DeBlanco, a very talented linebacker to the University of Cincinnati. But with Adam Bigkill reaching the end of his career, one could think Tony Jones could be the perfect guy to step in and win that job for the long term. Edmonton Elks receiver Kyren Moore will miss the entire 2024 season as he suffered a torn ACL. The team has since signed Tevin Jones, former Saskatchewan Roughrider, Montreal Alouette. JC, how much will the Elks miss Moore?
I think they'll miss him a lot. Like, Kyren Moore is not a number one receiver. He's not a guy at this stage in his career that's going to be a 1,000-yard takeover game type of guy, but he's a very versatile piece who had shown some good things for the Elks offense last season. It's unfortunate that he'll be missing here. Didn't play in week one. The Elks looked fine in that receiving core, so they'll keep moving on, but it's unfortunate for both the player and the organization that he won't be able to play this season. The Hamilton Tiger Cats have signed Taulia Tagovailoa, the younger brother of Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa. Dunk, could he be Hamilton's quarterback of the future?
It's possible, but there's a long way to go here. He needs to learn the Canadian game, all the nuances that come along with it. Playing the quarterback position, has a solid resume, the Big Ten's all-time career passing yardage leader, and obviously gets a lot of, I think, more attention because of his brother, Tua Tagovailoa, being a star at the University of Alabama, and then now with the Miami Dolphins. But there's a lot to learn and a lot for him to prove if he's going to even be a starting quarterback ever in this league.
We thank you, as always, for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. Please enjoy week two in the CFL and join us next Wednesday for our next episode after I go 4-0 on my picks and JC probably got them all wrong. Well, I guess except for
we agreed on most of them.
I guess, yeah, except for the ones we agreed on. That's not possible. But who knows? You know what? I'm putting the picks together this week. Maybe I'll just change yours if I don't like them. And that way I'll pull ahead on the pot.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.